Welcome to Movie Crush, a production of iHeartRadio. Hey, everybody. Welcome to Movie Crush. Charles W. Chuck Bryant here in my basement, and sitting across from me, mere inches from me, on my laptop screen, is the lovely, winsome, charming, fantastic Holly Fry from Stuff You Missed in History Class and How Stuff Works. Well, not even anymore. I guess we're just iHeart. It's so second nature to say that. Executive producer, Holly Fry.
Hi.
Hi.
Hi, I know. It's welcome to my closet and all of the shoes and clothes therein.
Yeah, we were, this is, in all honesty, everyone, because I'm not a good actor, this is take two. We had a bit of a glitch.
It was my fault.
But Holly is in her closet with all her homemade clothes and custom shoes, custom Vans, a lot of slip-on Vans.
A lot of those, yeah.
I see Star Wars Vans.
Well, those aren't Vans brand, but they are that style.
Okay.
Because Vans would not print those.
There's not that option?
No, because it's I don't have a license for those.
What are... Oh, that's right. And they'll just say, nope, can't do it because you might sell them.
That's exactly correct.
Well, yeah. What are your Star Wars shoes? Let's name them.
How long do you have? Like, I literally have a whole bunch. Like, I have...
What are your top five?
Oh, my top five. Okay, I have a lot that are not custom that are from the brand Pozu, which makes, they're an amazing sustainable, sustainably sourced shoe brand, and they make fabulous stuff. And I have a lot of their stuff. But for mine that I have made custom, I have several Greedo ones. One of my favorites is a pair that is, it's kind of like a stretchy pull-on sneaker, and it's based on... the Louis the 14th design that you can get on slippers at Versailles, okay. Except it's Greedo.
Oh, man.
I have a couple of Princess Leia ones. I have old school classic Princess Leia in her white outfit. There's a great photograph of Carrie Fisher in that costume, and it is not one of the photos that regularly circulates where she's just got this great sort of impish grin on her face, and it's like the most Carrie Fisher that Princess Leia has ever looked.
Yeah.
And so I had that put on shoes. And then I have some from the sequel trilogy where she is a mature woman, because I love some of those shots as well.
Yeah.
I have a lot of Star Wars shoes.
Boy, how, like, the moment when you first see her on the more recent films was just like, you can't be our age and not just lose it the second she comes on screen. All of them, really.
Oh yeah, I mean, Carrie Fisher in particular, right, is one of those women who I think for women my age, and particularly ladies who are not necessarily like really gonna fit in the mainstream, she was very much like the North Star, mm-hmm. right, outside of Star Wars completely. Like, I remember picking up her books when I was a teenager and being like, "Oh my God, I'm still a weirdo, but I'm not alone in my weirdoness. Like, other people deal with these same sort of weird brain jumps where you're processing the world differently from other people." And she's just so witty and sharp. And I mean, who wouldn't be in love with that? So,
Yeah. I mean, God, she was the best. And I think they handled her passing with class and as best they could. Mm-hmm. And I think they did a good job kind of weaving her into that story in a way that didn't feel contrived.
Yeah. And I really like that her daughter was very much a part of that process and very much sort of the keeper of that legacy and making sure that it was true to what, you know, her mother would have wanted in that case. So. Yeah.
Well, I thought before we, and by the way, I would love to count on you for sort of a series of Star Wars, whether it's, we'll do some, just the two of us, maybe we'll get together. I know Annie wants to do Empire Strikes Back, so maybe the three of us can do that one.
Happily.
And Paul is really into, I think, Rise of Skywalker, so we could get some different combinations of people together. I think that would be fun.
Yes.
And this has
happily.
Way too long in coming. it took a quarantine and pandemic to finally open up our schedules, I guess.
Yeah. I mean, I will talk Star Wars till the cows come home, and then I'll talk about it to the cows. And then the cows will walk away, and I'll be like, is there a sheep or a gopher that wants to talk about Star Wars?
And in my version, some cute little gopher raises his hand and it's like, sure.
Yeah. Yes. I really like Babu Frick.
So before we get going on Rogue One, though, I thought I would love to just hear a little bit about, because everyone knows you love Star Wars, but I don't know how often you've, in a public forum, you've been able to talk sort of personally about your entree into it and what it means to you and what it meant to you then.
Yeah. So for me, Star Wars and I share a birthday. A New Hope, which was then just called Star Wars, came out on my sixth birthday.
That's amazing.
It was just so cool.
Wait,
and
what
I,
was
of
the
course,
date? May 6th? May 4th? 25th. Why is May the 4th to be with you then?
Because it
Oh, it just
it
sounds like May the 4th?
Correct. Correct.
So it was when? May 26th?
25th.
May 25th.
Yes.
Okay. So I was born March 15th. So I'm just a couple of months older than you.
2 months older than me.
Okay.
Yeah. And so there may have been some coercion to get an older sibling to take me, which they did not relish, but there was, which didn't matter because 5 minutes in, like, everybody else stopped existing to me anyway. I was in a movie by myself.
Uh-huh.
Again, like, being six and seeing that on the big screen and not really knowing what it was like the best mind blower. You can't replicate that.
Yeah.
And then my favorite part of it as a kid and still is Greedo.
Why Greedo?
Here's why Greedo. Because I remember so distinctly when Greedo came on screen. Like, we had seen other alien species already. We had seen Jawas at that point in the film. And, mm-hmm.
But they were
and
mysterious.
Whatnot. But they weren't really interacting with humans in a big way. Like, the Jawas kind of, like, make their little mamaloo, and they gesture, but they're not really conversing.
Right.
And Greedo was the first character that came into a scene, and he had a scene with Han Solo, and they were actually talking, even though he was speaking Huttese. Which, by the way, nobody ever talks about how multilingual Han Solo is, but that's a thing.
that's a good point.
Right? He just picks up everything. But I was, like, so excited as a kid. I was like, yes, this is actually what I came to this movie for, was aliens talking to humans.
Yeah.
And then he was gone, and I was like, well, shit. I want more. And luckily, there's been more in, like, the Clone Wars and stuff. But and we have, you know, Chisito in Solo and appeared in The Mandalorian briefly. But
oh, that's right.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, I love my Rodian background characters. for me, like, the cantina in particular was really important as a kid because it was, like, the first instance I can think of in media where I saw a place where everybody was a total weirdo and nobody was a total weirdo.
Right.
Like, they were all marvelous and fantastic to me, but within that scene, nobody... Or the bartender did not care whether you were a Shadra fan.
Right.
Or, you know, a Deveronian. They're just slinging drinks. They don't care. Which I like. I like the alcoholic bat creature, which is that little Shadra fan that goes up.
Uh-huh.
Her name is Cabe or Cabe, depending. Different people like to pronounce it different ways. In the EU, in the books, they kind of reveal that she was an alcoholic, which is weird. Weird Star Wars trivia for you.
Yeah, well, I'm glad that you're here of all people, too, because you know so much. Like, I saw it in the theaters when I was 6 years old, and I saw it 5 or 6 times, and I was there for Empire, and I've seen them all, and I love them all so much, but I never dove in to the books and the world to where I knew all the stories and all the planets, and I was a medium diver. I was never the deep diver, so that's why when I say, why do they call it May the 4th, and you were very sweet about that, by the way, didn't just say, listen, dumb shit.
No, I mean,
say
look,
the words
like,
out
I
loud.
Recognize that I have a unique level of rabies in this.
Yeah, that's right. There's a lot of foam coming out of your mouth right now.
Right. But I look like a raccoon that you found in your garbage in the middle of the night.
Yeah, I will say things throughout this episode that are like the Diego Luna character and things like that. So
no worries.
Okay. I'm pre-apologizing to you and all the big Star Wars fans.
No, you shouldn't. And this is like a thing I have a soapbox about because there is a problem that crops up in Star Wars fandom where there are a lot of people who want to like throw their weight around as being Star Warsier than thou.
Yeah, not into that.
And like, I don't care if you wanted to memorize planets, like some stuff I'm really into and you don't have to be. Everybody who loves Star Wars is a Star Wars fan.
Yeah.
I don't like that weird gatekeepy stuff.
Good. Because, you know, I was always there on opening night and it's a big deal to me, but I'm not a deep diver on movies like that. I am for music and my recall for Emily's always making fun of me. She's like, you can't remember the conversation we had yesterday, but you can name the fucking bass player for Poison.
Right. Yeah. And see, I would be a stumbling, a completely lost in that world.
All right. Well, I just wanted to level set so I don't get in trouble. So the cantina, you're 6 years old. Take it from there.
Yeah. So, I mean, at that point, I just like was in love. And I remember like I and my best friend and her little sister and her little sister's best friend, like we spent the next several years just playing Star Wars, which kind of cracks me up when you hear people say that like Star Wars was for boys. I'm like, I didn't have a boy who was a friend of mine that wanted to play Star Wars with me until like way later, but like our little herd of girls was way into it. But so I loved it as a kid and I, you know, continued to love it. Empire was like,
yeah,
I mean, aside from the fact that it's Princess Leia's best clothes.
Yeah. And you know what? Empire, looking back. So how old were we? I guess 9. Was that 3 years later?
Mm-hmm.
That was a lot of semi-sophisticated movie making and emotional filmmaking for a 9-year-old, I think.
Oh, yeah, for sure. And there are certainly like aspects to it that I did not fully appreciate until I was much older.
You know,
at the time I was like, Ugnaughts and space. And then I remember so distinctly when Jedi came out. So we would have been 12.
Mm-hmm.
And I went and saw Jedi and I was super into it. And I remember going to school and saying something to someone about it and them going like, Star Wars is not cool. And so I was like, all right, I'm not going to have anybody to talk about Star Wars with. The thing that sucks is that like that was kind of my MO all through like high school. And I did not even realize until we were in our 30s that one of my closest friends in high school was a huge Star Wars nerd,
mm-hmm.
as was I. And we never once talked about it.
Oh, wow.
Like we did not discover that we had both loved it the whole time until we were much older.
That's really funny. So, my deal with Jedi, that's the one I had the most problems with. Even back then, and I think I pinpointed it years later, was that, and I still like Jedi, but I loved those characters as they were. And there was a big character shift in Jedi,
mm-hmm.
to where all of a sudden Luke was a badass. And I liked the Luke of Discovery more than I like, I'm a badass now, Luke. That's why I liked Empire so much, I think, because the process with he and Yoda, so into that. And it just felt a little too winky, like we've been here before and not quite as pure.
Right.
But that
I can see that for sure.
It didn't ruin my love of it or anything, but I just love those first two so much.
It wasn't like a hatred of Ewoks.
No, I don't remember we were 12, so I probably wasn't charmed as I would have been when I was 6 or 9.
Right.
In an Ewokian way. But I don't remember thinking like, ugh, I'm too old for these little Muppets.
Right. I love those Ewoks.
of course
do.
You do.
I do. Oh, Tebow forever, man.
Is there one thing you don't like? Name one thing you don't like about Star Wars. The whole universe.
See, I'm a little reluctant, and here's why.
Okay.
Not because I want to be like ebullient about everything, but there is one particular thing that I dislike that comes up in the literature a lot.
Okay.
And I don't want to dog on a writer because there are other people that love those things.
Yeah, yeah. I hear you.
But like as a blanket statement, I will say I don't generally like romance in Star Wars for a variety of reasons. Okay. Admittedly, like romance in media is not my jam. I don't want a rom-com. I don't want like, I need some lasers. I don't.
Right.
But yeah, so there have been some things like that that I haven't super loved. I am still coming to terms with, spoiler alert, The Rise of Skywalker and Rey's lineage. Still not in love with that.
Okay.
But other people super love it. So like my, you know, my opinion isn't any weightier than anyone else's. Like, love what you love, but I don't super love that.
All right. I'm just noticing your Rebel Alliance necklace.
I also have a Rebel Alliance ring on. Okay. I have a Greedo ring on. It's a problem.
And it has nothing to do with recording this episode.
No, absolutely not. I would be worried. What you can't tell, this is so Dorkalopithecus, so brace. So in Galaxy's Edge, i.e. Nirvana, which is the expansion in Disney Parks that's all Star Wars.
Yeah, can't wait.
Oh, we go a lot. Or at least we did before this pandemic.
Yeah.
One of the things you can do is build a custom droid. They're like a probably a 12 to 15 inch tall, like remote control droid. Mm-hmm. And so my beloved and I went on our anniversary in December and we decided we would build droids that looked like our outfits from our wedding.
Mm-hmm.
Which is super nerdy in and of itself. But then I took pictures of those droids and I made them into a floral fabric print, which is the jacket that I'm wearing right now.
And I'm like, oh, you dressed up for this. And you're like, what are you talking about?
Like, these are my clothes, Chuck. I don't, it's this or no clothes. And I promise you, that's not anything anybody wants to happen. Yeah, it's all Star Wars all the time.
It's funny to think about being there in December. That place is probably swimming with coronavirus at the time, unknowingly, right?
Maybe. We didn't get sick that time. I mean, I often come back from Disney sick just because there's a million people, right? And, you know. But we went then. We actually went in March as well.
Oh, wow.
Kind of right before this all started. There was an event that I was booked to do there. And I had even, like, reached out to the event organizer beforehand, and several other women from iHeart Podcasting were supposed to go, and I was like, is this still happening? And they were like, absolutely. And I'm like, all right.
Was this a Star Wars event?
No, this was a like a podcasting event.
Oh, okay.
But of course it was in Orlando, and of course I'm not gonna be in Orlando and not sure. Go to Galaxy's Edge every night.
So
we went then, and we were very like heightened level of care, and so was Disney already. Like, they already had mm-hmm. like the standees of hand sanitizer every 4 feet, and we're being a little more careful. So we didn't get sick at all that time, which actually surprises me. But December. I mean, we tend to go September through like maybe late March.
Okay.
And then we don't usually go in the heavier summer
sure,
months.
Of course not. You're a veteran.
Yes.
What is there an actual cantina replica there?
There is a cantina. It's called Oga's Cantina. Oga is the proprietor. She is a hard ass kind of criminal underworld. You don't ever meet her while you're there, but it's a really spectacularly fun place, I have to say.
Did you cry when you walked in?
I cried the first time I walked into Galaxy's Edge, period, because mm-hmm. it is so breathtakingly beautiful. And I don't think I cried the first time I was in Oga's. The first time I was in the one in Anaheim, not Orlando, because I was in LA for business. So, of course, I was like, doink,
yep.
I'm moving over here. It's so fun. It's very, I wonder how that is going to play out post-pandemic, because it is normally a very packed place.
Right.
Like, they literally, like, pack you in at the bar. It's, like, 80% is standing. There are only a few tables that are, like, booths. And you get seated with people you don't know. So I have no idea how they're going to play this going forward. I mean, I know they're, like, figuring out plans, but I don't know what they are.
It'd probably be, I mean, if you're a little brave, a pretty great time to go. Because I imagine they're going to be limiting entry such that it's going to be, like, you know, a ghost town.
Well, I think you can't right now. Oga's is not open, even though they are. Well, and right now, California is not reopening.
I think it's hard to say about July at some point, right?
Disney World is set to open currently mid-July. And initially there will not be food. I don't think any of the food service is going to be open.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a little, I mean, we're still waiting it out. I'm going to hang in my house with my cats and my husband.
No.
Until this is all over.
We're with you. I don't want to get sick.
But back to Star Wars. So then, as an adult, I just kind of let my freak flag fly and stopped caring who did or did not like Star Wars or thought I was a dork about it.
Right.
And that's kind of how I met my husband. He actually met my roommate first, but then called our apartment one night. That was before cell phones where you had landlines. Mm-hmm. And I ended up picking up the phone and she wasn't home. And I was watching Empire, and he goes, "Is that Empire Strikes Back on in the background?" And we ended up talking on the phone, and that is how we met.
Wow.
So, yeah, and here we are 24 years later.
It's amazing.
So that worked out. Yeah, and it's been one of those things where, you know, as I got older and the internet developed, you could find other Star Wars fans. My best friend on Earth is someone I've known for, like, 22 years, and I met her on a Star Wars costuming forum.
Oh, cool.
And yeah, and now I actually do a Star Wars podcast every week. So I have like a whole nice little like hour of my week where I know no matter how stressful or weird everything else has gotten,
uh-huh.
and just sit down and talk about, you know, Padme or an Ewok for an hour. It's great.
Now, what is that?
It's called Full of Sith.
I don't think I even knew that.
It's a secret. It's not a secret. It existed before I was on it. My co-host, Brian Young, and our producer, who sometimes hosts, Mike Pilot, started it years and years ago.
And this is outside of our job? It's just your funsies?
Yeah.
That's great.
Yes.
I'm going to have to check that out.
Yes, it is one of the grandfathered projects in my contract that I'm allowed to do outside of work.
You know, when it just now hit me as we go through these films with you and other people that actually A New Hope is off the list. That's the only movie that I've done because Taron Killam.
I know. I'm going to address something he said.
Let's hear it.
Later on. Well, we're talking about Rogue One today, ostensibly, even though we've been talking about everything else. But there's this interesting thing, and I'm not going to say he's wrong at all, but I just want to make a counterpoint. Because he mentioned towards the end of that episode that Rogue One kind of messes up A New Hope for him, because at that point, you know what's like just transpired in terms of Leia just getting the data, the Tantive IV taking off, Vader watching it take off. And then so by the time we see Vader boarding her ship and her saying, "I don't know what you're talking about," you know, that all feels a little weird to him. But to me, it makes her that much more badass. Where she's like, "I know you just saw me take off, dude. I know you know I'm lying, but I still don't know what you're talking about, boo." Like, she's just like, nope.
I love that, too.
She's 19, and she is standing up to this terrifying monster of a creature.
Yeah.
I'm like, damn, Leia is a badass.
Yeah, and it's almost like in front of other people, too. So, like, I'm going to stand you down in front of other people. Like, it's a bit of a power play.
It totally is. Yeah, like while his stormtroopers stand there, she's just like, "Listen, schmucky."
Yeah.
That's a really, really, I mean, it to me, it elevated her even more.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I don't remember him saying that. I love that you listened to that episode. Of course you did.
Of course I did.
Well, let's go ahead and get into Rogue One then. This is a movie that I saw one time before last night. I only saw it once.
I only see it once every 2 weeks. I mean, I love this movie. It's on in the background all the time at my house.
I do, too. And I will say this, you know, ranking the films is always a bit of a, like, wank. But this is top three for me with Empire and New Hope. It's number three, I think.
Yeah, I don't rank either, but it's a very tight race with this and Empire for me, for the ones that I just want to go to over and over and over.
I love it. It's a bit of a caper movie. It's a bit of a heist movie. It's a bit of a war movie. It has elements of all those things. I got Chris Weitz was actually a guest on the show one time, too, and I got to talk to him a little bit about it.
Yeah.
I just think he and was it Tony Gilroy?
Mm-hmm.
I just think they nailed this script, and they gave...
And Gary Whitta, we should not leave him out.
Okay, yeah, please correct me along the way because there will be a lot of that going on. But I think they gave Star Wars fans something different that was still very much Star Wars, but it was just outside of I mean, what do you call, you don't call them the trilogy. What do you call the
canon? Oh, the Skywalker saga.
Okay, the Skywalker saga. It was just outside enough that it felt, it just felt different, and it didn't have that, it didn't feel encumbered. It didn't have that baggage, which I think freed it up a little bit.
There's also some really interesting direct, or I should say, like, they're direct inverses of A New Hope that go on in this movie that I think is really wonderful. Some are just visual. Like, I love the fact that, so in A New Hope, the first time we see Vader, it's this man all in black, flanked by armored men all in white. And the first time we see the villain in Rogue One, it's Orson Krennic all white, and he is flanked entirely by black death troopers. And it's just like a flip on that that I really love. But really, that goes back to Gareth Edwards' whole approach to this film initially was that it was the counterpoint to A New Hope, in that A New Hope is this story about this naive, idealistic farm boy who then wants to become part of the bigger galactic conflict and become part of a war.
Right.
And Rogue One is about a young woman who has grown up in the war, and all she wants is a peaceful, quiet life.
Yeah.
And, like, it's such a beautiful counterpoint in that regard.
Yeah. I never really thought about that.
I think about all this stuff all the time.
Well, and... You know, the arcs for both of those characters are so great because Jen, you know, when she, after the death of her father, was when that switch is really turned on.
Yeah.
She goes in so hard and becomes such a leader so quickly. It's really one of my favorite parts of the movie to see that transition happen.
Yeah, there's, for people that are not into all of the extra stuff, there... is some really interesting payoff for people that have been keeping up with all of the extra stuff. One of the fun sort of, it's not even an Easter egg, but it's interesting. Saw Gerrera, who trained Jin, was trained himself by Anakin Skywalker in guerrilla warfare.
Okay. And this is from, like, books?
Clone Wars. It's from the animated series.
Okay.
So in the animated series, Saw and his sister are part of this resistance to occupation of the Empire on their planet of Onderon. And the Jedi can't technically get involved, but Anakin trains him, trains their little, their group. And so it's kind of interesting then that there's this reversal where Anakin, of course, goes on to not be such a great dude as Darth Vader. And yet the seeds that he planted are still undoing the other work that he's a part of, which is kind of interesting. And then Saw, in turn, trained Jin as a kid.
Right. And he, I mean, I guess when you dive into the books and Clone Wars and stuff like that, you get a much more richer experience seeing something like when Saw first comes on screen. I say, oh my God, Forrest Whitaker, how fucking much do I love Forrest Whitaker? And all of you folks are going, oh my God, it's Saw, it's Saw.
Well, what we're actually saying is, whoa, life has really taken a bat to Saw Gerrera, because when we saw him, he was this very young, strapping, like super handsome, you know, young man right on the precipice of his life. And he, in the course of that, this is a little bit of a spoiler, goes through a great trauma, which leads him really to go in hardcore as a resistance fighter.
So you know what happened to him that made him, you know, mechanical?
We don't really. We just presume that, like, he was just fighting throughout. Some of it comes up. There is a book, and I am blanking out on the name of it. It's like a young adult book about Jin's time with Saw Gerrera, called Resistance Rising, and they talk a little bit about some of that, but it doesn't go super deep into it.
Okay.
Well,
what I was talking about though is just the unencumbered feeling. Like they, you know, they didn't use the opening crawl, and they don't use the wipes and things like that. And I think that was just really smart to just get the smallest bit of distance. So where you're not, it's not heresy or anything like that, but just enough distance to be like, you know what, these stories are in the world, but they're off to the side a little bit, which I think it just freed them up, I feel like.
Yeah, and it's interesting. It's the first Star Wars movie that was not scored by John Williams.
Oh, interesting.
It was scored by Michael Giacchino in like a 4-week period, because I think originally André Desplat was supposed to score it. He had to step away to work on something else.
Uh-huh.
And Giacchino, who is an amazing composer anyway,
yeah,
you know, was like, I've had this in my head since I was 16. Like, I'm ready to, you know. And so he banged it out lickety-split. It's interesting because I remember thinking, how weird will Star Wars feel without John Williams' music? But in many ways, like, this score has become as much of what Star Wars sounds like to me as anything.
Oh, really?
It's so beautiful.
Oh, that's cool. Yeah, I thought the score was great. I thought the geography, too, was just so exciting and new. Just from that opening shot flying over the oceans and things that we haven't seen before. And then the end... battle on that tropical planet.
Scarif.
Yeah, it was so cool to see these characters at this, you know, resort-looking location. It was just so fucking awesome.
It's funny that you mention how it looks like a resort, because similarly, I have just through happenstance in life lucked out in Star Wars timing, in that if the films come out in May, they're always near my birthday, and mm-hmm. if they come out in December, they're always near my anniversary.
Oh, cool.
So Rogue One came out on my 20th anniversary, and Brian and I were in Hawaii at the time. So we went, as we do on opening nights, we go twice in a row. Like, uh-huh. we'll go to the 6:30 showing and then, like, you know, do a half hour break to pee and get snacks. And then we go right into like a 10 o'clock or whatever.
That's great.
And so what was great, though, is that at the end of the second time of Rogue One, we walk out into essentially what looks like Scarif. And it was just like, this is the best night of my life.
That's amazing. That is so cool.
And, it was very cool.
And it's weird, too, because that we hadn't seen that kind of world before. And I think if someone had told me about that before, I would say, ooh, I don't know if that will mesh with this world. But it does. It just looks great.
Oh, it's beautiful. It's so spectacular. It's an interesting thing. A lot of Star Wars people really like to debate about. I don't know how much you remember of the initial teaser trailers that we saw for Rogue One.
A little bit.
But they had a lot of footage that we didn't see in the final film.
Oh, really?
Right? Like, there is footage of Orson Krennic walking through the water with his cape dragging in the water, and it looks very ominous yeah. and beautiful. And there was some footage of the rebels kind of running along the beach carrying the Death Star plans, which shifted out. Like, it went through some shifts late in the game. And my understanding is Gareth Edwards filmed a lot of stuff that never made it to screen, because he just likes to film and experiment and keep things rolling as he uh-huh. goes. And then it got reshaped a lot along the way. But I would just like to see all that footage of Scarif and everybody running around in the water, because it looks so beautiful.
Surely they'll put that out at some point, right?
I don't know. I really don't know.
Do they do that?
They do. They have included some. I'm trying to remember what all the deleted scenes were when they did the home video release initially. But we really didn't get all of that stuff, unfortunately. I'm ready for it, too.
I also love how just this movie has such an energy to it that the opening 15 minutes, the plot is just coming at you so fast and furious. And you go to all these different locations and they're just banging out these locations right in a row. And just the setting... The table setting in this movie was just so energetic and fun, I think.
It is. And it's interesting, right? You mentioned that it sits sort of outside the bounds in a way that you can come into it without too much baggage. And what's interesting is, right, you know, essentially, that the odds are that by the end of this movie, all these people are gone because we never see them again, right?
Yeah.
And so it is this weird little encapsulation where you're just like, okay, I'm going to take the risk that I fall in love with everything about these characters in this story and know that at the end, I don't get to keep seeing this world or these people.
Yeah, I don't think I knew that going in. And I mean, I watched half the movie last night and then was so sleepy. I was like, I got to finish this in the morning to do right by it. And I was fucking on my couch this morning at 7:30 crying.
I believe it.
Like a little baby boy.
That ending is some of the most beautiful, poignant cinema. That shot of Jin and Cassian embracing on the beach while their death comes. And meanwhile, like that spectacular stringed orchestra in the background that you can hear. And there's that one, it's like two frames of shot where Cassian's eye in goes into like sharp contrast as the light from the explosion comes in. And it's just like an intense visual moment. It's so beautiful.
Yeah. I had forgotten Holly, cause you know, I only saw it the one time. And as this was going on, I was like, oh shit, that's right. It's like everyone fucking dies, which is not a Star Warsy thing to do. And I think I remembered, it took me back to being in the theater and thinking like, man, that was ballsy to do that to these characters that you've just fallen in love with.
It is, right? I mean, it's one of those things where it's Star Wars. So there's always the possibility that you will see them in some other iteration. There have certainly been books and there are animated things and they time jump where they'll be like, no, we're going to tell the story of this 20 years prior. And
yeah, that's true.
But even so, like, I mean, who wouldn't have wanted to see Jin become a leader within the resistance after this, because she comes in like a snarling, slightly feral animal and then gets so focused in, particularly after she watches that heartbreaking recording of her father and realizing that he gave up his life for the resistance, essentially.
Yeah.
Like for her to have gotten that center and then carry on would have been amazing, but we don't get to find that out.
Yeah. I mean, that takes a lot of courage, I think, as a filmmaker, to sort of lay it out and say, you know, this is the one movie and we're going to give you a clean, clean stakes. Like the setup is so clean and like right there at like the 16 minute mark, all the stakes are laid out there for you. And throughout the movie, it was like, it was just easy to follow. There was, because of there wasn't any baggage, it was just a very simple, clean setup. And I think it benefited because of that.
Yeah, I should mention, as we talk about losing all these characters, we didn't really, because we're getting a Cassian Andor television series.
Oh, really?
Yeah, on Disney Plus. Tony Gilroy is actually, I think, the showrunner on it. Uh-huh. I know he's basically heading up writing. And
with
it'll be
Diego
like
Luna?
Cassian before we see him in Rogue One. So,
but
it'll
is
be...
it Diego Luna?
Yeah.
Oh, va-va-voom.
Yeah, totally. I'm in.
He was so great in this. He fits so well in this world.
Oh, yeah. You know who I really, really love in this movie? Is Wen Zhang.
Oh, God.
Like.
Yeah.
Chirrut and Baze both are fantastic. But I don't know why I love Baze Malbus. Like, I love him. I think Wen Zhang has... It's interesting because there were criticisms when the movie came out of people going, oh, you can tell he doesn't really speak English very well and blah, blah, blah. And he accidentally gave something away in press, which in the
oh, really?
Press junkets leading up, which is a thing. And partially because of that. But the thing is, like, you could just do a still shot on that man's eyes and you get all the information.
Yeah.
He's so good in this.
Yeah, he is. And boy, those two... what was his buddy's name?
Chirrut Imwe.
Yeah, I mean, I'm so mad in a way that this is all we get of them, because they're two of the great Star Wars characters. They're one of the great duos in this universe.
They really are. And there's been some additional stuff with them in the books. There's a middle grade book about them trying to like rescue the kids of Jeddah. Before all of this happens, really wonderful. But yeah, I could watch the two of them for literally days. Like, you could just make that a channel that runs 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, and I would watch it.
Yeah, because I want to know their backstory, because they have a very sweet relationship. There's that one great line where he's like, I've got you. What does he say? I'm not in trouble or whatever. What does he say? I'm sure you know it.
I'm trying to remember, because it's when they're on Edu and
he said, you're going to go do this by yourself.
The thing, and he says something like, I'm not going alone, I have you.
Yeah.
I'm like, oh. And Baze, of course, is like, damn it, let me get my gun.
Well, let's talk about that gun for a minute. Like, just when you, like, they managed to keep introducing new weaponry that is just so cool. And I think that's the first automatic weapon we've seen in this series. It's just so badass.
There's a lot of badass in this movie that we hadn't seen before, like the Death Troopers.
Yeah. Was that the first time for them?
Was the first time for them. You know, it's interesting because there are subtle things about their design that may not be obvious to people that aren't big Star Wars people, but you're still feeling the impact of it. Like, they're much taller than normal stormtroopers.
Oh,
and so, and their armor is cut a little more angularly. So they look like more like a weapon, like they look sharper.
Yeah, they totally do.
Interesting. And then they show up again in The Mandalorian. The bad guy that appears towards the end of that series shows up with Death Troopers.
Oh yeah, that's right.
And I'm always happy for more Death Troopers because they just look spectacularly cool.
I love The Mandalorian. I thought it was so good. Wasn't it
great?
We'll
talk about that if you want, happily.
No, we can actually do an episode on The Mandalorian. That'd be fun.
Nice.
Was this the first time that we had seen ships coming in from hyperspace?
I don't think so.
Because I don't remember seeing it in the others, but I remember that being a new thing in these new movies. And it's just one of those little small things that I was like, oh, wow, we've always seen the launch into hyperspace.
Right.
We've never seen them come in that quick stop. And I was like, it's such a very basic little thing, but it was so awesome.
Well, and there's also that moment where the rebel ships are trying to jump to hyperspace, and as they're going, the Imperial fleet comes in and one of the rebels just slams into that Star Destroyer, and it's like, oh, you don't think about those possibilities.
I know, that's true. I didn't really thought about that.
Yeah. Here's an interesting thing I wanted to mention.
Okay.
It's, again, this is a nerdy deep dive moment, but it goes back to my beloved cantina. So there's a moment when we're on Jedha, and they are walking through the crowd, and they bump into Ponda Baba and Dr. Evazan from the cantina in
He's
A New Hope, right?
Nose guy, right?
Right. And Ponda Baba is the one that lost his arm to Obi-Wan.
Right.
I
don't like you.
And Dr. Evazan is apparently like a messed up, unscrupulous doctor, literally, who does all kinds of weird stuff. But what's interesting is that this is another thing that then colors the way other films are perceived, because when you realize they have gotten to Tatooine and they just want a damn quiet cocktail because they have barely escaped the explosion of Jedha.
Right.
And then some pipsqueak and
that's funny.
Jedi friend come in and just screw up their entire day.
I didn't even think about that with the... I mean, it definitely makes you think about, I mean, how you should really watch this is watch this and then watch New Hope right afterward, right?
Yes, I highly recommend it. It is really interesting from that perspective. There are a few things like that. The thing that I was going to point out that would not be obvious unless you're a super dork is Mon Mothma.
Uh-huh.
Which is that the actress that plays Mon Mothma, Genevieve O'Reilly,
yeah,
already played Mon Mothma in filming for Revenge of the Sith, but her part was cut, but they brought that same actress back to do this.
Now, was this the first time we've seen Mon Mothma in a movie? No, right?
No, she's in Jedi.
Okay, and she looks like the actress that played her then, right?
Yes.
Okay, because I remember when I saw her in this, I was like, wait a minute, I think I've seen her before.
Yes, she's the one that does the many Bothans died to bring us this information when they're talking about the second Death Star. Yes.
Oh, God, I'm glad you're here. let's talk for a minute about the droid star in this.
K2SO.
Yeah, like how brave is it to also be like, all right, we're going to introduce another droid that also calculates probabilities and statistics, and they're going to be kind of funny, and but they're not 3PO, so fingers crossed that this works, and it totally does.
Well, I mean, you start out of the gate in a pretty safe space when you cast Alan Tudyk in that part.
Yeah, of course.
There is a great moment because Alan Tudyk was on set in like the rig doing the stuff.
Oh,
he wasn't
really?
Just doing, like, looping the audio later.
Oh, cool.
And there is a very, very funny moment when they get cornered on Jeddah by Saw's people and by the stormtroopers before Saw's people. And they're telling, like, K2 is trying to pass as a legit Imperial droid and not reprogrammed. And he slaps Cassian and says, "And there's a fresh one if you mouth off again." That was ad-libbed. And watch closely, you can tell that Diego Luna is losing his shit behind his hand. Like, he is falling apart laughing.
Oh, that's great.
Because who wouldn't?
That's such a great line. I love K2. Yeah, it really works. And again, I think it's fairly courageous to throw another droid in there with a lot of the same function as 3PO, but he's a beloved character in this.
Well, and the great thing too, the big differentiator, right, is C-3PO is like a nervous Nelly, and K2 is just like, he gives no dams, he does not care, he knows who he is, and he doesn't really care to coddle anybody.
No, you're
he's
right.
More like, you're stupid, whereas C-3PO is like, oh, why won't you listen to me? Like, that's the difference, right, is... Listen, idiot. I know.
Yeah. I love him. And I was sad that he's, ostensibly not going to show up again.
His death is...
It's tough.
Painful. When he's yelling climb as he's like, it's so good.
It really
is. So good.
There's so many great self-sacrifice moments in this movie.
It's the just whole sort of thing,
one after the other, yeah.
It's a little bit startling. That to me was the thing where I was like, again, knowing we probably weren't going to see these characters make it through. Mm-hmm. And I was like, how do you play a movie where all the characters die and possibly all through sacrifice and not have it start to feel just like reiterative? And in fact, no,
it didn't.
No,
no, it really didn't. Because I think each person has their own moment that felt real. I think that's the thing. It felt really earned and really real.
Yes. Yeah. I also love that Krennic dies in the most petty move on Tarkin's part.
Yeah.
Did you notice that laser goes right through the tower where Krennic is?
No.
Yeah.
Well, let's talk about Tarkin. I was about to call it the elephant in the room, but it's, let me level set where I stand with this, which is a cool idea, and I'm glad they did it, but I wish they would have pulled back a little bit. I thought the most effective moments were when it was a little more in shadow, the reflection when you first see him, and I think they could have pulled back a little bit more and made it feel a little more real than when it was finally like, here I am in full light right in front of you looking CGI.
So here's an interesting thing. This is one of those things where I think their idea was so big, and in fact, their skill is so big that it doesn't work everywhere, because I, of course, saw this in every format.
Mm-hmm.
And like, we saw it, I think we saw it in 3D the first time we saw it, and we saw it in regular 2D the second time. And then we saw it.
You're like, I got a special 5D screening because I'm Holly.
No. No, but do you know what I did? And they don't do it anymore. Regal did this promotion for Rogue One where you could buy a metal engraved ticket ahead of time for like $100 and you could go see Rogue One every day at a Regal cinema in any format for as long as it ran. And
did
let
you
me
do
tell
that?
You, I'm pretty sure I'm the reason they don't do it anymore. I was there every single day training the kids on how to use them in the system, like every day.
That's great.
But what was cool is that also, like, you could go to an IMAX movie and use that same thing. So, like, it seemed like a big outlay initially, but, like, you go to IMAX a couple times and, like, 3D a couple times and you paid for yourself. In IMAX, Tarkin looks incredible.
Oh, yeah.
And so it's like they optimized for like the most high-end format, but that damaged how it plays in other formats, at least in ours. I had compared notes with some other people because that also saw it in multiple different formats. And like they had some some different takes on which one looked best. In my case, and some of that like comes down to literally the theater you're sitting in and how they manage their equipment and stuff like that.
Yeah, exactly.
So I feel like they optimized it for best possible projection.
Mm-hmm.
But that meant that, like, if you saw it in 2D, he does look uncanny valley.
Yeah. And, you know, here's my thing is I'm a Star Wars fan. I don't lose sleep over this stuff. So I don't go in there wanting to pick it apart. It took me out of the movie a little bit, but I was also like, you know, I rolled with it. It was cool to see Tarkin again, and I know that's why they did it, and it worked for the story. So, and the same with Leia at the end. It was, you know, what are you going to do? You're either going to sort of throw your cards on the table and do that, or you're not. And they did, and it was fine.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting, right? Lucasfilm has always been at the forefront of technology and figuring out what comes next. I mean, I was watching, I don't know if you've been watching Disney Gallery on Disney Plus, which has been a whole season of behind the scenes of The Mandalorian.
Mm-hmm.
But I think Kathy Kennedy at one point names the number of patents that Lucasfilm owns. And it's like ridiculous. It's like 160 or something.
Oh,
I'm pulling that out of my tail, so I could be way off. But it's because, I mean, even from day one, they were changing the way things happened. And like even in Empire, Phil Tippett was changing the way stop motion was made with Go Motion. And like then when you get to the prequels, like all of that was advancing filmmaking in a whole new way. And in some ways, it doesn't always work to the human eye. But like if it weren't for that, we wouldn't have a kajillion other movies we've had since then.
Yeah.
So that's part of the tempering element for me there where I'm like, because I actually had a harder time with Leia than I did with Tarkin. But again, I admit that there's like an emotional component there that I can't get over that barrier. Like it's my own thing.
Right.
But even so, like when I think about what films are going to come later as a consequence, I'm like, well, that's fine.
Yeah.
They're trying stuff. They're not resting on their laurels.
Yeah. If you're going to get really upset about someone making a bold decision and trying to sort of punch above their weight grade, then I mean, that's how I'd want to go down as a filmmaker, not by playing it safe.
Well, what's really interesting is that this whole idea for the movie was originally pitched by the head of ILM, John Knoll.
Oh, I was going to ask you about that and how this great idea of like, wait a minute, let's go right before New Hope.
Yeah.
And let's cover the story of the Death Star and explain this weakness and why it was there to begin with.
Yeah.
Brilliant. Brilliant idea.
John Knoll. He is brilliant.
Wow.
John Knoll, who he and his brother also invented Photoshop. So, I mean, this is a man who has changed our lives in many ways.
Holy cow.
I think his brother heads up more of that now. Like if you load Photoshop, you see Thomas Knoll is the first name on it and it's his brother.
Now, when you say it was his idea, how did that all come about?
I'm remembering this without notes or review, but I believe I saw him in an interview say that at one point he literally just ducked his head into Kathy Kennedy's office and said, I have an idea I want to throw at you. And that's how it started.
Amazing.
And it is such a gem of an idea.
Yes, it's so great.
Because it was the thing he always wanted to know, right? Like, why does the Death Star have this really stupid, messed up engineering problem?
Well, that was a complaint, I think, for many years, right?
Yeah, people were like, nobody would put that much money and effort behind a project and have a stupid way to destroy it. But in fact, that was the trap.
I love it. I mean, did you say it's a trap?
I did. Very carefully.
Yeah. I think that it was a way to kind of shut people up about that, but in a way that makes for a great story. I mean, it made perfect sense, you know?
Oh, Galen Erso. We haven't even talked about him.
Yeah, boy. He's a handsome man.
He is. Well, so there is another book, and I'm sorry I keep referring to books.
That's all right.
Called Catalyst, which was written by James Luceno, and it came out right before Rogue One. And it is the backstory of the relationship between Galen Erso and Orson Krennic, because they actually knew each other back in school. And then there was another incident with Galen's family where they got trapped on a planet.
Uh-huh.
in unfortunate circumstances, and Krennic was the one that saved them as kind of part of his machinations of like, this genius will be indebted to me and I can put him on my project. And all of that is super fun to me. Like, Krennic is my favorite villain maybe of all time.
He's great.
That great moment where they're on Lamu, which is that first planet we see, and everything is just falling apart. And he literally says, they have a child, find it.
Yeah.
Tells you everything you need to know. Especially when you later see a flashback of him in their home with the kid. And you're like, oh!
He's cold, motherfucker.
Damn!
Yeah, and he's such a bad... I mean, Ben Mendelsohn is just great. He's such a good bad guy. And because, especially in this film, he's menacing, but he's also petty.
Oh, you see his hubris.
Yeah, you're going to mention me to the emperor, right? Like, that ends up being his undoing, of course, to a certain degree. But, boy, he's just great in this movie. He just chews it up.
Spectacular. My favorite. I mean, above Vader, above Maul, above any of the villains.
Oh, wow, really?
Oh, yeah, easily. Easily, because it is... there's a more complexity to it, right? Like, he's not, even though he does kind of go super villain.
Yeah.
You see that it's this man who has all of this ambition and is clearly very smart and has a lot of power. But like, the moment where I'm like, damn, is when they're on Mustafar and he's gone to see Vader, and Vader has just choked him. And the pull away shot is him smiling just a little, because any damn attention from the boss is a dopamine hit. Like,
it's almost, he's like, boy, I just got choked out by Vader. Wow.
Right.
Not many people live to tell that story.
As another nerdy sidebar of other content you can consume, if you want to see that same point of view from that scene where you're kind of way up in the tower on Mustafar.
Yeah.
For anybody that has an Oculus and you're into VR, the Vader Immortal series has a section where you're up on that platform, and it's quite beautiful and cool.
Well, I know what some of those words meant.
I love Vader Immortal. Whew.
Now, what is that? Is it a...
It's a VR game.
Okay.
That ILM XLab did. They put it out. It's one of those things that it's interesting because the Oculus headset, right, which is a VR headset, there's a barrier to entry there. They are not cheap. Like, I think the one we got a couple years ago, I want to say, was like $500, which is not cheap. There are a couple of cheaper ones than that. But then, like, the games are like $10. They're cheap as dirt. So, and they are completely immersive VR, which has been very, very fun. There is another, if people want more Cassian and K2 in particular, if you go to The Void, which is like a... it feels wrong to call it a retail establishment, but it's like a place you can go and have a VR experience.
Yeah.
They do a Star Wars one that has Cassian and K2 in it.
All right. Everyone, go check it out.
I will keep you posted on all the places you can consume all the things.
No, you should. Trust me, there's a lot of people that are listening right now that are like, oh my God, I'm so glad she mentioned that. That first Death Star weapons test is really cool. It sort of recalled the very first one from A New Hope. But this one, just the filmmaking was so much more advanced. It was one of the more beautiful shots in the movie.
It's so spectacularly beautiful. Like, when Krennic says, oh, it's beautiful, you kind of have to grudgingly agree, even though he's commenting on the beauty of destroying a bunch of people.
Yeah, that one shot where the explosion is almost reaching up toward that far into space or whatever. It was just gorgeous.
Yes. I will ask you a question. Did you have that thing? I know some people got really weirded out about the Death Star being inverted so that the...
Didn't notice.
The laser array was down, you know, the dish. And it's like, it's space, you guys. Like, there is no up or down.
I didn't notice. It's usually up, I guess. Yeah.
Yeah, no, most of the time when you see it, you'll see it with the dish on the top hemisphere. But then when we see it over Jeddah, it's inverted and the dish is on the what looks like the bottom hemisphere in that positioning.
Well, and so the idea is that this is a ship and it can turn upside down and it's...
And it's in space. There's no up or down.
Yeah,
everyone's
change isn't falling out of their pockets. And
right.
We get some good Vader in this movie too. He's not in it a lot, but that last scene is that might be almost Max Vader as far as badassness.
That is the most vicious Vader we've seen.
Yeah, right?
Because we see it, right? So in episode 3, we know that he killed kids, mm-hmm. right? There's that whole thing of him killing the younglings, but we don't see it.
Right.
But in this, it's just like fling a guy up against the ceiling, cut him in half as you walk by.
Yeah.
Like, vicious Vader. So if you remember when he first enters the Tantive IV in A New Hope,
yeah.
like all those guys are lining up and they're positioning themselves to defend the princess and the ship. And now we know that they have just witnessed the wholesale slaughter of a bunch of their comrades at this person's hand. Like, they basically know, like, I'm going to go get in position to die now. I mean.
Yeah, it really gives that so much more texture, I think. I don't know why I never thought to watch these two back to back. That's such a no-brainer.
Well, now you can do it this afternoon. It will feel like. And you'll be like, Holly said he trained this guy. And now you'll know. It'll be great.
I loved the reveal of how they got the title of this film. I thought that was so fun and so cool.
Do you know a lot of people hate that moment?
I loved it.
I think it's sweet, sweet, sweet. And we have not talked about how great Riz Ahmed is in this movie.
Yeah, he's awesome.
This whole cast is like A+ across the board. There are no weak links in this film.
Yeah.
But a lot of people don't like the kind of like cheesy borderline vaudevillian response of Rogue One. There is no Rogue One, but I love it.
Hey, I was along for the ride. I thought it was cool because I went in knowing or not knowing, obviously, why it was called Rogue One. And I think I kind of forgot while I was watching it, like, wait a minute, why is this even called that? And I thought it was kind of fun, and it sort of recalled a little bit to me the way he was on the mic, just sort of saying, Rogue One. It reminded me of Han Solo. When he was answering the stormtroopers or whatever.
Yeah. And then we get to see a nice little Easter egg in that we got to see Dutch Vander and Garvin Dreiss.
All right, now who's that?
Dutch Vander was Yellow Leader. Or Gold Leader, rather, in A New Hope. And Dreiss is Red Leader. That footage is stuff that they found on reels at Lucasfilm.
Oh, wow.
Like Gareth Edwards had said, you know, I think it was one of his first visits where he was like just poking around in the archives and saw these reels and was like, what's that? And the archivist was like, oh, those are some of the unused films from A New Hope. And he was like, can we watch them?
Wow.
And they ended up using some of that footage to drop them right into Rogue One. And we see why Luke gets to be Red 5, because we see that Red 5 just got killed.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I knew there were so many things like that that I didn't pick up on that were just like, I'm sure this movie was littered with stuff like that.
Yeah. There is a character in Rogue One where they're kind of like warning him. He is an Asian pilot, and he's saying like, I don't remember his exact words, but he's basically in distress. Things are going poorly for him. And then we see him get shot down right after. And it's like, oh, that's why there was a number available for young Luke Skywalker to step into. I see.
That's so cool though. And you know, me without my deep knowledge, I was just like, oh my God, R2-D2 and 3PO. There they are. That was fun too.
Yeah, I mean, it's really, like, for me, this is silly, but, like, seeing Dutch Vander is where I started really crying in this movie, even though there was a lot going on. It was just a weird, I'm in Hawaii, and it's, like, my anniversary,
sure.
And it's, like, a magical time anyway, so I'm
feels.
Right on the edge of crying at every moment. But, yeah, it was just, I don't know, it felt like the nicest, like, hug from the past,
yeah.
But in a not overwrought way.
Yeah, what are we supposed to think happened to R2-D2 and 3PO right after this?
They had to have gotten right onto Raddus's ship.
Okay.
Right? And then been transferred over, or they were on the Tantive IV inside Raddus's ship, and then, you know, when it dropped out, they were off with it.
All right.
We haven't talked about Raddus either, because I love him.
Yeah, let me, which one's Raddus?
The bluish-gray Mon Calamari.
Right.
who is on the big ship, which is called the Profundity.
Yeah, yeah.
He's based on Winston Churchill.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
That makes sense, sort of.
Yeah. It's a, you know, some of that is a visual. He's got a lot of chin.
Yeah.
And but he's also just kind of like a stalwart leader who probably doesn't always make the right decision. But we have not also talked about the problems of the rebellion and how it runs.
Yeah. So, I mean, one of the cool parts of this movie, I think, is when was when you get that switch from the Alliance saying like, no, we're not going to do this. So they have to go rogue, to then that moment where they mount up and charge in full. That was a nice little change. But what was going on there before?
Well, I just think it's interesting in that it's one of those instances where you see that any kind of organization, whether it's in leadership or not, where they really try to govern by everyone having a voice and a fair choice, like, it's inherently messy.
Mm-hmm.
Which I think is an important thing to remember, particularly in our modern times,
yeah.
Right? Like, we complain all the time about, you know, how leadership in government is often messy, but the way that it's not messy is when evil people just get to call the shots. And,
right.
Like, that's an important thing. And it sucks sometimes. You don't always like the outcome.
Yeah.
But then I do like that Raddus was just like, I'm taking my ship anyway. You guys, I'm out.
Yeah.
That wonderful exchange with the character's name is Antok Merrick, the general in the blue.
Uh-huh.
With the Ben Fields. Is that the actor's name? Where he and
Mon
Mothma and the communications officer are having the conversation, and he's
yeah.
like, no, they already left. Like, you're gone.
Well, and that just sets up that whole final sequence is just so thrilling and so action-packed. And it does one of my favorite things in any movie is when you've got like five different things going on that are all intercut and interrelated, and just the dance, the editing in this movie is so great, knowing how long to spend in each little piece of that puzzle to keep that story moving in such an energetic way is just great.
Yeah, especially because there's a lot of gear shifts in terms of energies, right? Like, the stuff with Jin and Cassian in the tower is often very quiet and
uh-huh.
tense, whereas then there's all this frenetic stuff going on the beach and in the air, and then we cut to poor Bodhi that just seems like he is fighting a losing battle at every turn, and it's sort of like stressful in a different way where you're
yeah.
like, oh damn kid, I wish I could help you.
Well,
and
so
all of that all of that move together,
yeah,
you're right, it's a it's like the best conducted orchestra you could imagine.
Totally. And I think there was something so kind of funny and relatable about sort of the big plot point hinging on, I need to get a cell signal so I can send this text. Like, that's kind of what it came down to. But it was, as it turns out, super relatable to a modern audience because we've all sort of been there.
Yeah.
And it was kind of funny in a way that's like, oh, that is the big suspense in this movie is they got to get a fucking signal to send this text.
Yeah. Yeah. It's, oh man, Jin just like basically being like falling apart as she's hucking it down that trailway or that gangway to
yeah.
get to the one thing. And then that computer with the very lulling voice going, like telling her she's
repositioning
everything
the tower.
Is not okay.
Yeah. Yeah, it's we've all been in those situations technology-wise. So I think, I mean, and I'm not kidding. I think that really did make it more relatable.
Oh, yeah. It's interesting. That is another one of the things that I have heard people complain about, like that it didn't make sense. Like they couldn't quite parse out what was happening there. And like the
really
whole
simple.
Idea of this data transfer thing. And of course, there's a very, I don't know, dark part of my brain that's like, can you imagine if Raddus's ship had not gotten that signal and they all just died for nothing?
I know. I mean, that's the other way it could have gone.
Yes.
And that
thank
moment.
Thank goodness for the Mon Cals.
Yeah, that moment when they, And again, it's sort of lo-fi in a very cool way when they have to bust a hole in that shield so you can get that signal out, and they just fucking push that destroyer into the other one. It's so like kind of brutally lo-fi.
Yeah, that whole Hammerhead Corvette thing is, whew.
Yeah, that's exactly what it was.
Yeah. I think that is a point in that movie that I think what has been officially said might be different than what comes up in the novelization of the movie. Because I think in the novelization, the people aboard the Hammerhead Corvette did not make it. But I think in official documentation, they have.
Oh, really?
It's just an interesting, nerdy point to
make. Yeah. Well, I mean, it would have just been another sacrifice of this film, though, huh?
Yeah. There's a great passage in the book, though, where Raddus is kind of talking about it in his head. Like, his inner monologue is at this, like, meta level where, because he is an aquatic creature where they have broods of just thousands of eggs, they don't look at death the same way that humans do. And, like, it's this really beautiful kind of meditation on life and death and how different people perceive it based on their own experience and their own perspective on where they are in the bigger picture. And I wish everyone could have that in the movie because it's so good.
Yeah, totally. You know, this action is playing out at the end. It's one of the, maybe my favorite, battle sequences and aerial battle sequences in the franchise. It was so, so well done.
Oh yeah. It's interesting. The U-Wings, which were a new ship for this movie. I remember before we saw it, my husband was like, I don't know how I feel about U-Wings, but boy, he came out of that theater like, U-Wings forever.
I'm looking at the U-Wing. Oh, yeah, yeah. Those are so cool.
Yeah, like they have that weird shifting, rotating wing structure.
Yeah.
That just, it's interesting. I keep saying it's interesting, which it is all to me, but it it harkens back a little bit to some of the Doug Chang designs on the prequels. There were a lot of ships that had a similar shape when it's got its wings in the forward position. At least to my eye, it looks very similar to a lot of his stuff.
Well, it's tough when you're designing these ships in later movies because they nailed it so out of the gate with the X-Wing, like the coolest ship ever, and the TIE Fighter even. It's tough, like, it doesn't get any cooler than to see a 500 TIE Fighters pouring out of a hangar bay.
Right.
Or those X-Wings flying in there when those wings separate. It's just like, oh, it's just so great.
It is really neat. Did you notice that they changed the design of the X-Wing for the sequel trilogy a bit?
No. What'd they do?
They now the engine splits along the wing line, whereas the engine used to stay intact and the wings would split.
So the engine splits
kind
now?
Of front to back. So yeah, it splits a little bit more.
I love these details, Holly. So let's talk about that final sequence. I know we talked a little bit about it at the beginning. You just know, because you know how drama works, that how do you pronounce Donnie Yen's character?
Chirrut Imwe.
Yeah, like, you know he's gonna be the guy. Like, that's just how movies work. It's gonna be that guy, and he's gonna do it in that way where he is one with the Force, and he's repeating that mantra, and he's walking just like the Buddhist monk, and it's just so powerful. Like, I'm getting chills even thinking about it right now.
It's a cool thing. There's a detail of design that I really love that comes up in his clothing as well as some other clothing in the movie, which is that characters that believe in the Force have red somewhere on their costume.
Oh.
Like if you notice Jin's mother Lyra, when she gets killed by Krennic, she's wearing like a red sash and a red sort of underskirt.
Mm-hmm.
There's a thing in the visual dictionary that mentions it's the sash of the enlightened or whatever. Like they're not people that are Force users, but they kind of believe in it in a sort of religious way.
Mm-hmm.
And so Chirrut also has it. Baze has it, but his is all dirty and like in those weird little knots and stuff.
Uh-huh.
But what's interesting is that when you know that and then you look at the film, you start to notice that only on the interior of her jacket, Jin has a red lining.
Oh, really?
And it's just like, it, you don't see it very often. It's just like flashes occasionally. Uh-huh. And it's like, oh, man. Like, when you think about the fact that this is a kid who has worn that one little, like, kyber crystal around her neck her entire life.
Yeah.
But grows up in this scrappy way where she claims she doesn't believe in anything, but she still has that little tucked in.
Yeah. Well, she says the force is with us, you know, once she makes that turn.
Yeah.
But boy, when he goes out and hits that master switch, and he and Baze is just like,
when Baze yells his name.
Oh fuck.
I'm not emotionally tall enough to ride that ride. Like the second that Baze bellows Chirrut's name, I'm just like,
yeah. Oh God, yeah. It's brutal. I mean, I'm in my basement tearing up. You're in your closet tearing up.
Well, I always cry in my closet a little bit. Cause I'm I love you, clothes.
It's just such a, I mean, this movie packs more of an emotional wallop than any Star Wars film, for sure, I think.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I'm sure there are people that probably gravitate emotionally to other ones. This one, for me, is it.
Yeah.
You know, I will say some of that is a personal proclivity in that, like, the Jedi have never been the thing I loved about Star Wars. Mm-hmm. But for a lot of people, they are. And so, like, that story and watching, you know, Anakin's fall from that group and ultimately watching the Jedi really, like, shoot themselves in the foot in many ways because they do get completely munged up on what their actual purpose is, in my opinion, might have more meaning. But for me, this is like, I love the idea of like the scrappy people that are all just coming together because they see something better that has to be made to happen. Like, to me, that's where the emotional punch is.
Yeah, because these characters are, they're giving it's a suicide mission, basically. I don't think they really know that going in, but the writing's kind of on the wall toward the end there.
Yeah.
And they're giving their life for a larger cause. It's big, it's heavy stuff.
Yeah, there's that moment where Jin and Cassian and K2 are in the vault, and K2 tells them, like, the rebels are here. And she's like, what? And he's like, they've closed the gate. And she goes, we're trapped. And he just nods. And she knows at that point, like, this is where my life ends, but I got to get this job done first.
I know. Oh, my God. Woo. And you talked about the romance. I think they did it just right in this, which was intimacy, but not romance. They didn't kiss. They hugged. And there's a big difference.
Yes, I agree. I think if they had kissed, for me, it would have felt a little bit cheesy. Again, for other people, it might have been different. There was allegedly a version of this script where it ended with a wedding.
Oh, no.
Allegedly. But there's a reason that version didn't get made, right?
Yeah.
Like, it got scrapped. It would have felt very strange, I think.
Yeah.
And there were characters that survived in that iteration.
I always thought it was interesting to play, because there's, you know, a bunch of different ways you can frame and block that final moment on the beach. And they chose to do it where she was facing the explosion and he was not. And I thought that was really interesting.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of those things where when you think about the fact that her father designed that explosion, essentially, at the same time he designed the thing that would destroy the Death Star, he also still had to carry out his primary mission.
Yeah, I didn't
really
think
about
that.
To use kyber crystals to make this weapon. When he says, like, they would have made it without me,
man.
In his hologram.
Fuck, dude. What are you doing to me?
it's a really, I mean, to me, it's just it's such a good film. It's why I love it so much.
It is. It's so great. Such a brutal ending. So courageous, I think, as filmmakers to, like we mentioned earlier, to make you fall in love with these people and then to take them away from you. It was just pitch perfect, I think.
Yeah. And with a lot of fun little Easter eggs for the dorks out among us.
Yeah.
Did you know Bib Fortuna's cousin is in this?
Who's Bib Fortuna?
So Bib Fortuna is the major domo for Jabba the Hutt.
Okay, yeah.
You know, the guy that Luke coerces to let him in. His cousin in the story, Beezer Fortuna, is in Saw Gerrera's little hideout where there's a little party going on. He's the one that looks like really gaunt and a little spooky. Like,
okay,
are you the malnourished of the Fortuna
right.
family? Like, you, you look like you didn't get enough vitamins as a kid, maybe.
Oh boy, Holly, you're great.
There's also a tie-in to Solo in that. Do you remember when Saw's people get Bodhi Rook and they're out in the desert questioning him?
Mm-hmm.
And there are characters that have these, like, I don't know, sort of a funky shaped head that they have tubes that come out of their little mouth breather that go to their thing.
That sounds familiar.
Their names are Edrio and Benthic Two Tubes, and one of them shows up in Solo as one of the Cloud Riders that Enfys Nest leads. I will geek out on the weirdest stuff for you forever.
Do you got anything else? I think we did it.
I'm like, and then we don't. Let me consult my notes. And I talked about that. Talked about that. Talked about that.
Done.
Talked about that. Yeah.
Well, you'll have a chance. Because we're going to do this again. I think we should just, like, maybe once every 6 weeks or so, kick off another Star Wars movie. We'll get you and Annie in there for Empire. That'll be fun.
Yes.
It's also a good way to hang and see y'all again, you know?
Yeah. I know. That's the downside, really, is that I miss seeing everybody. Even though we usually are so busy running around that in the office, we get maybe 4 minutes at a time to be like, oh, hey, how are you? How are the kids? How's this?
I miss those 4 minutes, though.
Right? Those were a valuable 4 minutes. I don't think anybody realized how
much
we really counted on those to get us through on like the roughest days.
Totally. I've been recording Stuff You Should Know in the office actually for the past like 4 weeks.
Yeah. How's that?
I had a technical malfunction and we lost a short stuff. And I was like, you know, I'm not risking it with like recording two full length episodes. That would be tragic.
Yeah.
So it's been fine, you know. There's no one in there. So
it's a ghost town.
It's as safe as my house, I feel like.
From
the car park to the office, nobody. So yeah, it's fine.
It's easy to get parking.
It's so easy. If you need me to check on anything while I'm there, let me know. I think all the plants are gone, so I don't need to water anything. But
yeah, I know. My desk is just a pile of mess anyway. Like,
well,
I asked you to check for something, you'd be like, I don't know how to tell what is garbage and what isn't. This is a mess.
All right, Holly. Well, that was a lot of fun. And everyone can look for, I'm sure this is going to, people are so excited about this. This has been a long time coming. But I'm glad that we were able to get in here and start with Rogue One. And we can go in any order from here on out. I think it'll be fun to kind of jump around.
I think we should do The Mandalorian next because the rabies is very high right now for that.
Yeah.
For me personally.
We can do that. Yeah, let's do Mandalorian next. That'll be great.
We might want to time it because the second season starts in October.
Okay.
So we could do it maybe as a lead into that, which is not that far away, by the way.
It's not. So maybe let's do one other movie. You know, I want to do Empire with you and Annie next. Let's do that.
Okay.
That'll be fun.
Sold.
All righty. Well, it was good seeing you, and take
care
and hug on those kitties.
I'm gonna hugs to the whole fam.
And thanks to everyone for listening, and we'll see you next week.
For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.